With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, I'm Alex McLaren. I'm an actor and I've worked as a communications coach since 2002. Now so much business is being conducted remotely, the ways in which we talk, present, build relationships and connect is changing. In this podcast, I want to explore all those issues and prove to you that no matter who you are, you can talk to anyone. Hello and welcome to You Can Talk to Anyone, the podcast where we open the bonnet on the way we communicate. This week, I've called it The Rules of the Round. I'm Alex McLaren.
I'm Tom Selinsky.
And we are going to be discussing the question of the balance of debt in friendships. So, Tom, this is a question that I've sometimes found myself asking groups of people. What are the rules of buying rounds? The first time I went to pubs was when I was about 16 and 17, and I was at sixth form. Our college was in a town in the middle of Preston. I had a bit of disposable income because I was working in a bookshop in Waterstones on Saturdays. And the local pub was the Blue Bell, Tom, which was a Sam Smith's pub. You were in London, so you won't believe this, but a pint was £1.16 for a pint of bitter. obviously, we were all young and poor and scraping together our pennies. And so if you bought a pint for three people and you, over the course of an evening, you drank four pints, which was possible in those days because I was younger, you basically had to have about, you have to have a fiver on you and you could have a night out. But we're also, I think you're kind of, you're just aware that we're all in the same boat and there needs to be a kind of an informal account book about who does what. And one way or another, you keep on top of it. Did you have the similar kind of system yourself?
Yes, very similar. And I think it is striking that there are ways in which this just sort of finds its level and people have a sense of how many people there are, how much disposable income is sloshing around. You know, I think when very wealthy people go out for dinner, it just becomes somebody's turn to pay.
Yes.
And everyone's much more relaxed about it because even though the bill might be hundreds or even a small number of thousands of pounds, that's very within everybody's means. And there is a pleasant generosity about saying, I'll get this.
Yes.
So whereas if you and I went to dinner with half a dozen people to somewhere fancy, we would almost certainly split the bill.
Mm.
Or we might split it forensically, or we might split it equally. Again, I think as your income level rises a little bit, you're more inclined to say, let's just split it equally. When you have people who have very high net worth, somebody will just say, I'll get this. But if you are a bunch of school leavers going out for somebody's birthday, and there's like a dozen of you, no one's going to say, I'll get this round.
Yeah.
Because no one person could afford to, because there's going to be 12 people there and maybe at most six rounds bought. So what some people I knew in that state, and this is actually when I started work rather than when I was at university, and it would be someone's birthday, instead of somebody buying rounds, everybody except the birthday girl or boy would put a fiver in a hat.
Yes.
And then we had a kitty to buy drinks
with. There'd be a kitty to work with. Yeah, it's interesting. The parity of the group matters, matters. But also, I think it goes, there's something here almost about class. Mm. I mean, I started from kind of sort of a local Lancashire pub with cheap pints. And I think that if you're poor, And I've not really been there. I mean, I basically, just for listeners, I don't sound very poor. My dad was a public school boy. My mum was a Lancashire lass. And so there's always been this kind of this illusion that we're kind of working class Labour voters in my family, but we're not. We're kind of culture vultures. That feeling of being conscious of everybody's resources, of other people's resources, your own resources, and that we've got to be absolutely fair about this, because it's not right to take advantage of somebody else's pocket. But then when you're in a world where there is a bit more variety, that's when it starts to become slightly more complicated. So something that's happened to me, well, it happened to me in my 20s, because I was kind of getting by on temping jobs and acting jobs and stuff. And I had friends who had salaried positions and in some cases mortgages. If somebody would invite you to a very expensive dinner, which was beyond your pocket, or they would invite you to an incredibly expensive stag weekend in a foreign country, and so you'd suddenly find yourself in situations way beyond your pocket. And that can put pressure, I think, on the relationship in ways that maybe the better off party in that circuit simply doesn't understand.
Yes, as Douglas Adams said, assumptions are things you don't know you're making.
Mm.
And that's key. It may simply never have occurred to the wealthy invitor that some of the invitees don't have the same means that they do.
Mm.
And so it becomes very difficult to point this out, because on the one hand, you're saying, I don't have the resources that you do, which feels humiliating. On the other hand, you're saying, you should have known that you're an arsehole, which feels aggressive. So nobody emerges from this feeling good about it.
It's true. I mean, I know that when groups of people who have had, you know, very, very clear kind of all their childhood sort of working class upbringings with very, very finite resources, that sometimes a thing that they really prize is the ability to have very smart school uniform. They squirrel away the resources for things like, I save this so that I can buy my round. Almost like I want to punch above my weight financially, and I'm not going to let the circumstances interfere with that. And so when there's an imbalance, sometimes those people can be incredibly prickly. They're, you know, reasonably. I fought hard for the freedom to operate within this world. And so when people try and kind of sort of help me out a little bit, it feels almost like, no, that pushes pride buttons that are painful. And I think I've occasionally had that sort of experience myself.
This reminds me of another thing as well, which is apportioning credit.
Mm.
I've always been a big believer in, if there are multiple people who are contributing to the same piece of work, that unless there's a very, very good reason to do otherwise, people should be credited in alphabetical order, because that seems fair.
Yes.
One of the reasons I can advocate for this is because my surname begins with an S. My surname began with an A. I could not advocate for this because it would seem self-serving.
Yeah, because you're at the top. That's funny.
So likewise, somebody who knows maybe or guesses that they've had, you know, less than the average is in a much better position to say to the group, let's just split the bill evenly. Mm. That's quickest. And it means that we all trust each other.
Mm.
It's a way of saying, you know, I don't believe anyone was trying to game the system and order the lobster because they saw me ordering the green salad and is trying to get more than their fair share. But if you are the one who's ordered the lobster or the champagne, it's much harder for you to say, I think we should just split this evenly.
It is. I was thinking as well about the fact that there's also a sort of not just a financial dimension to this. There's a really funny essay by the novelist Robertson Davis, in which he talks about the story of the little red hen. And the little red, as you don't know, there's a little red hen that wants some help growing the wheat and goes around asking for assistance from the farmyard dog, from the cow, from the horse, and they all say no. And so the little red hen does it herself, grows the wheat and grinds the wheat and bakes the bread, and only at the point when there is a loaf do they suddenly want to help. And the little red hen says, no, I baked the loaf, and so I shall keep all my little chicks. You'll have the loaf and you shan't. And then Robertson Davis...
Which is kind of bitchy.
Well, it is. Well, that's the point he's making. He's saying it's all very Thatcherite, that and that it doesn't really take into account the warmth of the cow, the boisterousness of the dog, and the cheerfulness of the pig, and all the different contributions that all the other farmyard animals make. And I think that's relevant, that if there is a kind of a sort of a ticket price to a gathering, but there are people you want there that can't really afford it, then you've got to think differently about how you make the compromise. I remember I was a best man once for a friend of mine, and he was absolutely adamant, having sort of spent a fortune on sort of trips to Prague, that what he wanted was a pub crawl that everybody could afford, and that's what we did. And it was just a blast. It was a very kind of affordable, kind of old school event. But that mixture of kind of thinking, how do I make this a place in which everybody feels welcome, and that different sorts of resources are allowed for?
Yeah, and you're right. And people will contribute in ways other than financial.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're just sort of fun to have around. Or I'm thinking of the way that the South Park boys, I can never remember which way round it is, but one of them does 3/4 of the work, if not more.
Yes.
But they split the proceeds evenly. And the one who does more work says, I'm better because the other guy's there. He doesn't do as much work as I do, but he makes me better. And that's worth giving him 50%.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I have this feeling in my friendships, and I don't know if this is universally true. So talking about assumptions we make, I always feel slightly overdrawn in my friendships. My fear is that I am.
You've taken more than you've given.
Yes, that I've taken more than I've given. But I've been quite tough with myself, and I act on the basis that everybody feels a little bit like that. That we really notice what we receive because it's landing on us, but we don't really notice in the same way what other people are receiving from us. And so what I hope is that generates a kind of that everybody is works a little bit harder in order to try and sort of to even up what is actually an illusion, which means that there is more positivity generated within happy friendships and happy conversations.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out why that is, because I definitely relate to it. But there's a lot of research in psychology which suggests that people feel losses more keenly than they appreciate equivalent wins.
Yes,
and I think maybe with this friendship thing, it's as simple as we don't give what we can't afford to lose.
Right.
But often the things we receive seem incredibly valuable to us, and we couldn't have survived without them. You know, if I agree to help you move house.
Mm. Yes.
Which I have done.
Which you've done, yes. We've both done that for each other in our time.
We have. Then I won't volunteer for that if I feel that you're asking more than I'm prepared to give.
Yes.
But you'll know the huge difference it makes trying to get everything packed up and moved out with a couple of friends to help than doing it on your own. So to you, that will seem enormous. But to me, I wasn't doing anything else that day. I may as well spend some time with you.
Yes, yeah, you do. You remember it solidly for years on end. Yeah, I was thinking just the participation of more people. When there's an onerous burden, anybody offering to share it makes a much bigger difference than the time it saves. It's that feeling that you're not alone with it, which makes a big difference. My New Year's Eve involved 6 people making Chinese dumplings. I've done that job myself. It takes forever, but with 6 people, it took sort of 10 minutes. It was extraordinary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's an interesting question. Have you ever had a gift or an input into an interaction or a friendship that felt like a burden? So that sometimes somebody makes an offer that's so generous, you kind of feel a little bit like, oh God, no, that's too much. I don't think it's always healthy to think of relationships as kind of like an account book, but I do think it can sometimes interfere with sort of happy conversations with each other.
I don't remember feeling like that. I know what you're talking about. I relate to it. I can't think of a specific example from my own life. Can you?
Well, no, I suppose I'm thinking of occasions when people make offers and you feel uncomfortable. And I think maybe the reason is that it's disturbing is that it indicates that you're in slightly different places with each from each other about the sort of the nature of the relationship. Or maybe just the feeling that this goes back to what you're saying, that they're making an offer that you wouldn't be prepared to make yourself.
Yes.
And so it says something about either resources or about assumptions about other people's need, maybe, that makes you feel
vulnerable. Yeah, some very wealthy friend says, well, I'll fly you there on my private jet. I cannot reciprocate in kind further down the line.
That's true.
I, for my part, will make you a very nice sandwich.
Yes, indeed. Let's get back to the specifics of the first thing we said about the rules of the round. Let's imagine that you and I, who know each other very well, are out in a pub and there are three other people, one of whom doesn't drink alcohol. And let's also imagine that one of those people is an 18-year-old who is just about to go to university, so legal to drink, but not got loads of cash. And one of them is somebody who doesn't have a job at the moment and we know is strapped for cash. We arrive at the pub and I say, guys, my shout, what would you like to drink? Everybody gives me their order and I go to the bar and I buy five drinks. One is somebody goes, I go, no, go on, get a cocktail. So it's expensive. A couple of pints of beer. One of them is a Coca-Cola and I bring them all back. We've now got five drinks and the conversation ensues. Then what happens? Would you go next?
The way you described it, yes, I think I probably would.
Yeah.
I would be trying to, again, this sounds so calculating, but I'd be trying to sort of assess the buying power of the people around that table and try to go roughly in order and hope not to get all the way down to the bottom, to the impoverished student. You got in first.
Yes.
That makes me very determined to go second.
Yeah, cover the student, absolutely. What would you do if you absolutely knew that, maybe if we didn't know each other well, and maybe it was kind of a group of strangers meeting us, and we'd gone to the pub afterwards, and we were introducing ourselves to each other, would you insist on going first?
Well, there is almost
how hard would you push?
There is almost this sort of race to see who can get there first, isn't there?
Yeah.
I would be a competitor in that race. It's more important for me for other people to see me as generous than it is for me to hoard my pennies.
We really are kind of washing our bank account linen in public. I was just wondering. I'm trying to think of occasions when you've had to explicitly say, "Guys, I can't be part of the round game." Have you ever had to do that? Or I'm not staying for long enough to work our way round this circle of five. So I know I'm going to have to leave this group because you got in first without reciprocating. And so it will sit there on the ledger, if we don't know each other well, potentially forever. Then we just have to live with that.
Yeah, I think on the occasions that's happened, I have just sort of accepted the drink that someone else bought me. And then slunk off into the night.
This is it.
Hoping it won't come back to haunt me.
I think this is what's so fascinating to me is that something of which it should be about kind of benevolence and sharing can often leave people with these sort of emotional kind of bruises, which take some time to fade.
I guess what I'm hoping is that other people will see that offer the way I tend to see it myself, which is I've offered to buy a drink, not because I think the number of drinks consumed by me should equal the number of drinks bought by me, because if that was my goal, I would just say everybody buys their own drink. I've offered to buy a drink because it makes me feel good to be ostentatiously generous.
Have you ever this is really fun for me just to look actually at what's going on behind the smiley, happy faces of people having a fun time at a party is that there's this, it's
such absolute, a killjoy.
It's true of everybody.
Just let people have fun, Alex. Just let people have a good time.
Occasionally I come across this. I've never done it, but occasionally you come across kind of either cultures or systems or even apps which can calculate how to make it easy to divide up the...
When the iPhone App Store first launched, about half the apps on there were bill splitters and such things.
So why is that? What's so fraught about that? Because I remember seeing, God, this is an issue. Either these are people who go out for dinner in groups a lot, which is not something I'm doing all of the time. But I know that if it's a something that you're doing very, very regularly, maybe, I guess, kind of young professionals in their 20s with a disposable income and living in a city, that this may be kind of happens so consistently, it starts to be a problem. But I was also wondering, you know, is it to do with a particular type of person? I'm talking about app developer brains.
It could be.
What if you are the person that doesn't eat three courses and cheese and port? You just don't like to do that at dinner. What if you're a vegetarian in a steakhouse and that you're simply operating in a different way, which has a financial consequence for which you can be penalized? I'm thinking of people who are teetotal in pubs, for example. I think that presents people with a particular kind of issue that other people need to be conscious of as well as they do. I think if I was at dinner at Hawksmoor with you and a bunch of other carnivores and had a generous vegetarian who was going to eat from the vegetarian options, I think I would be very alert to that and would want to get in ahead of it, even as we were sitting down, about just before we get to the bills, that Alice needs to be excused from the fair split. Are we all good with that? And likewise, I think probably with the rules of the round.
I think that the trick here is simply it is socially benevolent to say, what are you having? I'm getting them in. It is not at all socially benevolent to say, Sam, it's your round. You have to wait for Sam to offer.
Yeah,
you can't put Sam on the spot like that. Yeah. And so likewise with your vegetarian at Hawksmoor, I think, yes, you're right. As the person, maybe the instigator of the trip to Hawksmoor, the person who's invited the vegetarian who isn't going to spend as much as anyone else, it definitely does behove you to say, we'll all split this equally apart from you, and you can just put in whatever you think is fair. But again, it's about these displays of generosity. And I use the word ostentatious not as a critical or a self-critical description, but just to say it is a sort of a performance in a way. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but that is what's going on. It's very different from the let's make a kitty and trust that there isn't going to be one person drinking orange juice and someone else drinking pina colada.
Yeah, the kitty solution, I think, is I've certainly myself used it very effectively in situations where things needed to be relaxed in advance when you had a kind of an imbalance in terms of the resources of the people who arrived.
So the other good thing about the kitty is it can be topped up from time to time, which means if you start with 10 people, everybody puts a tenner in, and you get a couple of rounds, and then a couple of people leave, the people who remain could top up the kitty, and everybody still feels like this continues to be equitable.
Thanks very much, Tom. And basically, my homework for listeners this week is going to be very particular. We're giving you an insight into our own personal experience here and the kind of the weird wiring that affects Tom and my behavior in those situations. But yours may be very, very different. So we're particularly interested if you come from totally different perspectives on this, or you think we're wrong, or you think we're nothing like as nice as we think we are, then we'd be really, really keen to hear your challenges and your needling. So hold nothing back, pull no punches, and let us know your perspective on the rules of the round. I'm Alex McLaren.
And I'm Tom Selinsky. Thank you all very much for listening, and goodbye.
You have been listening to You Can Talk to Anyone with Alex McLaren and Tom Selinsky. The producer for The Spontaneity Shop was Tom Selinsky. You Can Talk to Anyone is distributed exclusively by Acast.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.